Today on Know How, you're going to learn what to do with all this stuff. That includes time-lapsing with a GoPro, fixing your Doge, and setting up your Wi-Fi.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Know How is brought to you by CashFly. At CACHEFLY.com.
This episode of Know How is brought to you by iFixit. You can fix it, and iFixit makes it easy with step-by-step repair guides, high-quality replacement parts, and all the tools you'll ever need. For $10 off your purchase of $50 or more, go to iFixit.com/twit and enter the code KnowHow at checkout. Welcome to Know How. It's the Twitch show where we build, break, upgrade, and show you how to reach your nerdvana. I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit. This is the show where we're going to pour the know-how into your head so you can take this stuff and turn it into something awesome. Now, I want to get a word here from my TD. You know, Brian, I know that you've done a lot of stuff with GoPro in the recent future, right?
Yes, I have.
So tell me, is there something that maybe you could show the good fans at home that could teach them how to do time-lapsing with the GoPro?
Yeah, it's a really good camera for doing that, and it's pretty simple to set up. So I did a quick tutorial and like to show you guys.
What do you think? Should we let Brian show him?
Do it!
Let's do it. Yeah, I got snubs. So if I got snubs, here we go. Time-lapsing with the GoPro.
So you've used your GoPro to take a bunch of pictures, and now it's time to turn it into a time-lapse. Now, an easy way to do that is to download the GoPro software from GoPro.com. They have GoPro Studios, and it makes it easy to combine your photos together to make a time-lapse. So once you've gone to the GoPro website and downloaded the software, you want to make sure you have your folders organized. I used two different GoPros for this project, so I have two different folders containing the different JPEGs. So on the left is where you import files, in the middle is where you can preview them, and then on the right will be your convert list. So I'm going to select all the photos that I had used, and what GoPro, the software, has done is put those photos into little movies. Now, most GoPro videos, you're going to want to clip the beginning and end, because if you're anything like when I use a GoPro, I'm looking at it to make sure it's on. You'll want to trim the ends. And once you've trimmed your clips to what you want, you'll want to go into the advanced settings and set what you want your photos to be. I went with 1080p. I want the photo size to be 16:9 widescreen, so it'll fit better when watching it on YouTube or something like that. Next, you can select your quality, low, medium, high. I'm going to go with high. And what I'd also suggest doing, if you're going to be doing multiple clips, you want to keep the settings the same. Don't forget to check the box for keeping the settings the same for each clip. So now I'm going to add this clip to the conversion list. And then I'm going to go to my second clip. I'm going to trim the edges because I don't want to see my face in the beginning of the time lapse. And now that I've done that, I'm going to add that clip to the conversion list. And finally, the third clip, I'm looking down at the camera again. I'm going to trim it right about here using the trim buttons down in the lower left hand. For the purposes of editing, I didn't move all the photos that time-lapse photos I did. Want to keep this kind of quick. And so now once you have your clips on the conversion list, down at the right-hand corner, you can convert them. And this will change them into MOVs so that you can edit them. Now the next step, if you want to edit these in the GoPro software, you can pick a template. They have a few that they've done before with maybe some popular GoPro videos that you've seen. I'm going to go with a blank template because I want to keep this pretty simple to start with. And you can drag, now that you have your clips in here, We can edit them, drag them down to the timeline. It's a pretty basic editor. If you want to do some serious transitions and cool stuff, you'll definitely want to just export your videos and use some other software like Premiere or Final Cut. But if you just want to do a simple time lapse, GoPro Studios works pretty well. Now you can see this clip moves pretty fast. Yeah, I've set it at 29 frames per second. That's just the default settings. But on the right-hand side of the software, you see you can have a bunch of different options for adjusting your clips. So I might, since this is a pretty fast pace and it moves around a lot, I'm going to slow it down a bit so that it's a little less frantic. You also have options to change the color, white balance, a bunch of different things. And down at the bottom, there's presets too if you want to add some you know, Instagram-y kind of effects to your video or give it a vignette. Next, I'm going to move my other clip up against the next one, pull down to the timeline. This one, you can see some clouds moving off in the distance and stuff. It's still pretty short, so I'm going to add another one, add a fade by pressing the plus button down here. And then I will add the last clip to the timeline that I have, do a couple of adjustments. Then you can go to export. And you'll have a few different options of what you want to export as. Presets for YouTube, Vimeo. So if you're sure you want to just load it straight to YouTube, you can do that. And that's what I'm going to choose. All right, now that we've got our time-lapse exporting, let's take a look at the result. To make it a little bit more interesting, I did add a few more clips off-camera. So in this time-lapse, I just kind of show what it's like a daily ride in January in California. It was pretty dreary to begin with, and I had to pull over and get some clam chowder to warm up, but pretty cool effect with the boats moving in the background. I stitched the clips that I have that are kind of short, I stitched together and blended, used the fade effect to kind of make them a little bit longer. But if you can leave your camera going for longer, you'll make a better video. Made it to the beach. You can see cloudy days do make for better time lapses when you're doing landscape. There's a little bit more to look at. If you're doing the sunset or a sunrise, you want to do maybe 20 to 30 second shot photos. And you have to remember the GoPro only has about 3 hours of battery life. So try and remember that when you're setting up your GoPro for a long time lapse. But it was a cold day, but at the top of Mount Tam made it worth it. Can almost make out San Francisco in the distance, and looks pretty cool with all the clouds going by. So that was just a quick introduction into doing a time lapse, but now you should know how to do your own time lapse.
Wow. Thanks, Brian. Now, I have noticed that anytime you do a time lapse, it is a really good way to sort of draw forth the beauty of an environment, especially San Francisco, which has so many microclimates. That's great. But Brian, let me ask you, I know that you used a standard GoPro. These things can do 4K, right?
Yeah, if only the Hero 3 Black Edition can.
Oh, okay.
But
okay.
Yeah, if you wanted to do a time lapse and use 4K for that, the one I just did, I did just regular resolution. I forget what it is offhand. But if you did 4K in a later time lapse episode, we can zoom in and you don't lose any of that detail.
That's
you
can right.
Do some panning into the time lapse and stuff, make it look cooler.
Yeah, if you're taking 4K pictures, you could always zoom in without really losing resolution because you're only using 1080 or 720p of that resolution. Okay. But my question would be this: what else could we do with time lapse? What's floating around in the cranky hippo brain?
Well, next thing I want to do is make a simple mount for the GoPro where you use a egg timer and it'll do a rotation around, and that would be kind of a cool time lapse to do too. So that's coming up next.
Coming up next on Know How. Now, it's projects like that remind us that we're geeks. We love to tinker. The stuff on this table right now, this is all the stuff that I've been working with just in the past week. And in order to tinker, well, we need the tools to do it right, which is why I'm happy to have iFixit as a sponsor of Know How. Now, iFixit.com is the free online repair manual for everything. Their free step-by-step repair guides are foolproof instructions to fix all your stuff. If you've shattered your iPhone screen, need to repair your game console, or swap the battery on your Galaxy S3, iFixit has got you covered. They have 10,000 repair guides for everything from electronics like your smartphone, tablet, and game console to your home appliances, clothing, and even, yes, your bike. They can even hook you up with the parts that you need to fix everything, and everything they sell is tested and guaranteed. iFixit also makes the most trusted repair tools for consumer electronics, including the ProTech Toolkit, which my wonderful producer Snubs is demonstrating right now. This kit right here is the pinnacle of the fixer, of the maker, of the gadget tinker. You get 70-plus tools to assist you with any mod, malfunction, or misfortune that comes your way. The toolkit is the gold standard for electronics work, from garage hackers to the CIA and FBI, but more importantly, their unique tools are used by repair technicians everywhere. They include iFixit's 54-bit driver kit with 54 standard, specialty, and security bits. Now, these are the bits that are hard to find, the ones that you need to open up those cases that the manufacturers really don't want you to open. It's all in here. They give you Phillips bits. They give you Pentalobe bits. They give you Torx and Torx security bits. They give you tri-wing bits and even the triangle bits. Yeah, you know, the ones that open up McDonald's toys. This kit has a bit for everything. They also have a swivel top precision driver and flex extension for hard-to-reach screws. If you've ever had to work in those really tight angles and you can't quite get the full tool, they give you this really cool flexible rod that will allow you to have most of the driver outside of the case and only pushing the bit inside. It's ESD safe, and they include tools like precision tweezers for delicate manipulation of watches or clocks. They have an anti-static wrist wrap that keeps your devices safe from accidental static discharge. They have a nylon spudger or metal spudgers and plastic opening tools for prying, scraping, and opening devices without scraping them up. It's lightweight, compact, and durable, and it makes on-the-go easy for repair professionals and amateurs alike. It's only $64.95, and it's backed by a one-year warranty. Hobbyists and home DIY fixers also use the ProTech Toolkit for doorknobs, eyeglasses, cabinet doors, sink fixtures, and more. In other words, if it needs to be fixed, you can fix it with this kit. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to fix it yourself with iFixit. Visit iFixit.com/twit for a free step-by-step guide. iFixit also sells every part and tool that you'll ever need. Plus, if you enter the code KNOWHOW at checkout, you'll save $10 off of any purchase of $50 or more. That's iFixit.com/twit and use the code KNOWHOW. And we thank iFixit for their support of KNOWHOW. Now, seriously, Brian, I know that you've used this kit. This is quite possibly one of the coolest things that we have in the brick house.
Well, I've used it to fix my glasses, so that helped me out a lot. But one thing I would really like to fix is my Doge wallet. I've been having some issues with that.
Oh, that's right. So are you getting that weird out-of-sync/DB error thing?
11-something exception. I filled up space, and I'm going to have to dig in, delete some files.
That's actually a good call, because we've had a lot of panic tweets and emails to the KNOWHOW account, because people are saying, wait a minute, did I just lose all my Doge? Well, the problem is that they switched blockchains, just because there have been so many Dogecoin that have been mined, and unfortunately, some people got caught in the switch. Now, there's an easy way to fix it. I think what we could do now is maybe do a really quick segment on Doge mining, just an update for all of our KNOWHOW Dogers out there, to both fix that syncing problem and maybe to keep your little video cards from blowing up. Well, hello there, you future Dogecoin billionaires. We've gotten some really good feedback on our Dogecoin-themed episodes, including some pictures of father-son teams, some really interesting rigs. But one of the things that bothered me was that in many of these pictures, I could see the temperatures on your CG Miner clients, and it wasn't a good thing. Some of you are running temperatures up in the high 80s, 90s, even 100 degrees Celsius. That's just no good. Here's an example of what happens when you exceed the thermal limits of your heat dissipation device. In other words, when you cook your video card. This came out of a machine from the brick house that was, I believe, being used to mine Doge. Now, the person who did it, we shouldn't name him. He should stay anonymous. I know it was you, Jammer B. But we could have avoided it if we had followed some simple rules for cooling off your Doge miner. The first thing has to be airflow. Just make sure that you've got enough airflow flowing through the case. And if you've got a retail bought computer, I can almost guarantee you don't, because those computers were not designed for that kind of heat, for that kind of constant use of the GPU. The easiest way to fix that is to take off the side of the case and put a supplementary fan. some small thing. It doesn't have to be big. You could use a box fan if you wanted to go cheap, but something just to blow air over the surface. Now, you're also going to need ambient temperatures that are cool enough to actually provide cooling to the computer. You can't blow hot air back onto the computer and expect it to bring the GPU temperature down. But watch that temperature gauge in the corner of the miner, and it should tell you whether or not your cooling is being effective. You want to get that temperature down, and more importantly, you want to get that heat away from the card, away from the motherboard. The second tip I can give you is to change the intensity of your miner. If you notice that you're getting blue screens, if you notice that you wake up in the morning and your computer has rebooted because it got too hot, or if it freezes up, drop the intensity. Dropping the intensity even 5 points can drop your temperature by 10 degrees, and that makes a big difference. Now, let's go on to something that I believe has a lot of people panicked, and that is if your Dogecoin wallet is unsynced, if it's giving you a warning that it's no longer synced up with the blockchain, or if it's giving you a DB error. I know that's scary because suddenly it seems as if you've lost your Dogecoin, but there's a really simple way to fix that. Let me show you how. The first thing that you have to do is to download the updated Dogecoin wallet. Now, I don't want to give you a link. Instead, I want you to go directly to the Dogecoin.com site. Get used to this because this is a way to make sure that you don't get a client that has been tampered with. You don't want someone putting in code there that's going to send your Dogecoin to their wallet. You're going to extract this folder onto your desktop. Then you need to change the settings, and I'm assuming that you're using a Windows computer here, to allow you to see hidden folders because we're going to have to get into one. Go to Start, Control Panel, Folder Options, then the View tab, select Show Hidden Folders, Files, and Drives, and click OK. Your computer is now set up to allow you to see hidden folders, which we're going to do when we navigate to the folder for your Dogecoin. Now, for me, it's going to be in C, Users, Blackrobe, App Data, Roaming, Dogecoin. But for you, it's going to be whatever your username is and wherever you stored your Dogecoin folder. Now, this is really, really important. You need to back up your wallet.dat file. Copy it out of the folder. Keep it safe. Make many copies and put them into different places. This is the file that actually contains your Dogecoins. If you lose that, they're gone forever. There's no way to get them back. Once you've copied your wallet.dat file, you now delete everything out of this folder. Go ahead and just empty it out. Toss everything into the recycling bin. Now jump back into the Dogecoin wallet folder that you just downloaded and start up the client. It may take a really long time for this to sync up. It needs to download the entire new chain, which could take a few hours, and make sure that everything is synced up. Once it is finished syncing, go ahead and close the wallet. Now here's the key. Once it's been synced up, go ahead and navigate back into that Dogecoin folder, the one that we had to enable the hidden folders to find, and copy your wallet.dat file back into the folder. Go ahead and overwrite the file that's in there right now. Once you've done that, you can reopen the wallet and everything should be back to normal, except that now you're on the right chain. Hopefully those two quick tips can keep you cool and keep you doging. Well, hopefully no one panicked when their wallet went out of sync. I actually got a couple of tear-ridden emails saying, oh my God, we've been pouring everything into this. We just finished mining 5,000, 6,000 Doge and we're afraid it's all gone. There are actually easier ways to do this process. There are things you could do that would speed up the blockchain resync. But the method that I just gave you is the one that has the least potential for disaster. No matter what you do, no matter what method you take to resync your wallet, just always remember that wallet.dat file is vital. That's where your Doge is. If you delete it, if you overwrite it, if you corrupt it, that Doge is gone. So protect it, keep it safe, have a backup, and Doge on. Now let's get on to something that I think a lot of people in our G Plus page wanted, and that is how do you properly set up a Wi-Fi system? Many people just go to your Best Buy or your Fry's Electronics or go over to Amazon, buy the router that has the highest rating, they drop it into their house, and they think that they're done. The problem with that is it's not quite optimized. I mean, let's for a minute, let's just forget the fact that if you do that, you're probably leaving a huge gaping security hole in your wireless network. It's also not optimized for wherever you live. There are so many tools out there, including the ones that are on this table, that you can get for free or for very little, that with just a little bit of effort, you can turn your Wi-Fi system into something that is rock solid. Now, for all the advanced geeks out there, we're going to talk about 2.4 gigahertz wireless. That's 802.11bgn in the 2.4 gigahertz range. The reason why we're doing 2.4 instead of 5 is because a lot of consumer devices are still stuck on 2.4. And 2.4, honestly, is where most of the problems are because there is so little spectrum. Now, before we do this, let's go over to my really poor drawing. This is a representation of the spectrum that we have for 802.11b, the 2.4 gigahertz, in the United States. Now, you'll notice that it goes from channel 1 to 11. You've seen this. If you've bought a new router, you've seen it say, oh, what channel do you want? And most of you have probably picked auto channel, which means it's going to look through the spectrum and say, well, I'm going to put myself in the first open channel. Here's the problem. You don't actually have 11 channels when you're talking about 2.1 gigahertz. You have three. There's only three non-overlapping channels at 1, 6, and 11. If you choose any other channel, it's going to cause interference. That's one of the little secrets about Wi-Fi, which is especially Apple devices, which are notorious for this, for putting themselves in like channel 5 or channel 7. If you do that, all you're doing is reducing the number of total channels that you can have in your home and your office. Don't do it. Always choose 1, 6, or 11. Now that I've gotten off that little soapbox, let me show you some of the tools that you can use to make your Wi-Fi work a whole lot better. Starting with something on this. Now, this is the Android version, but you can get different software also for iOS devices. This is called Wi-Fi Analyzer. I'm going to kick this off, and it's going to start showing me, if you can switch over to this right here, it's going to show me all of the different APs that we have here in the Twit Brick House. Now, you'll notice that Russell, our IT guy, who also suggests really good telephone systems to us, has done a good job of separation. They're only on 1, 6, and 11. Now, this may look like a mess. This may look like a cacophony. But because I'm sticking to those primary channels, it gives me the best chance for getting a clear signal. Now, this in and of itself isn't enough. You may know that we have sort of epic problems here in the Brick House. You can also look down the channel list here, the Mac ID list, to see what APs are broadcasting. This is handy in case you have more than one wireless source in your house. You can figure out where I'm standing. Do I have a lot of signal? Do I have very little signal? Do I have no signal whatsoever? You can go back to my wide. You need to look at tools like this as you walk around your space, as you walk around the house. Find all the different nooks and crannies where you might use a wireless device, be it your laptop or your tablet or your phone, whatever it's going to be, and check the signal strength. If that signal strength starts to dip, you're going to have to make a couple of changes, either moving an AP, changing the environment, or getting another AP. Now, this is a free tool on an Android device. You can also find it for iOS. If you want a tool on your Windows box, one of my favorites is called NetStumbler, Network Stumbler. Here's the problem. This program, although it's fantastic, doesn't work on every card. Right now you're seeing this little warning signal here saying access is denied. It's seeing the device, but it doesn't work on this device. If you're going to use this tool, search the forums, find a USB device that works for you, because if it doesn't work, you're just going to get the sign all the time. Otherwise, this is a very good tool. It works just like that Wi-Fi analyzer that I showed you. Now, the tool that I prefer, and it does cost a little bit. This is actually a $200 tool and piece of software. If you could go to my product shot, is this right here. This little thing sticking out of the side of my computer is a MetaGeek WiSpy. It's a device that's dedicated to looking at the 2.4 gigahertz range. I also have one for the 5 gigahertz range, but this, again, we're dealing with just 2.4. The reason why this is unique is if you're dealing with a standard Wi-Fi analyzer, you're only looking at Wi-Fi channels. So you're looking at this, 1, 6, 11, and everything in between. But if you have a MetaGeek WiSpy, you can actually look at the signals that are not Wi-Fi. If you cut over to my screen, you'll see what I'm talking about. Here we have a representation of all the 2.4 gigahertz activity going on in the Brick House. And you'll notice we get little bumps near those channel clusters. And you'll also notice that here we have a peak near 2 and 3. We have a peak near 8 and 9. And then we're getting all these little the bits and pieces up in channel 11 that really don't make it look good. You want a nice even curve. Anytime we see those spikes and anytime we see those hot spots, what it's doing is it's telling me that there's something there, there's something interfering. Brian's going to run you a video that I took from Interrupt a couple of years ago where we used this device to track down a device on the show floor that was causing interference. What we've done is we've hooked up one of these devices to the back of a laptop. We're looking at the signal strength meter, and it's telling us that there's a 2.4 gigahertz signal that's not Wi-Fi that's jamming up channel 11. And when we looked up, we found out that it was someone's little cute robot. It was one of these remote control devices. It was operating in 2.4 gigahertz, but because it wasn't shielded and because it was a bit too powerful, it just obliterated everything that was operating in that channel range. If you get a Wi-Spy, you could use it to walk around your house and find out, what are those devices? Do you have a Sonos system that is spamming all the channels? Do you have a microwave that is leaking 2.4 gigahertz radiation? Do you have cordless phones that are operating in that frequency range and are just making your Wi-Fi dirty? Believe it or not, those little steps can turn an absolute crap system into something that works really, really well. All right, so those are the tools that we're going to look at. The next thing that we need to look at is how you set up your APs. Right here, I've got a DDWRT router. This is an old Linksys WRT54G. Now, what I like about these is that they are so open and able to be fiddled with, but on the downside, they have a bunch of settings that, if you don't tread carefully, can be a disaster. Ryan, if you go back to my laptop, this is actually an old version of the firmware, but all DDWRT uses this. In the Wi-Fi settings, if you go to the advanced settings, it actually gives you the ability to change the power, the transmit power. And a lot of people who first start out think, oh, this is great. Look, the default's 28. Let me put this up to 250. And I'm sure that now, because I'm pumping out more power, everything's going to be good. The problem with that is that when you start looking at the channelizer, when this finishes making that change, you're going to see a lot more of these dirty spikes near the, see, there you go, channel 11. See, now it's getting spammed. And that's because this access point, it's pumping too much power. It's too much power for the filters that are built into it. And it's now flooding into other channels, and it's giving you really, really dirty signal. Dirty signal is horrible because it's only one direction, and it just blots everything else out. What you actually want to do, the proper way to set these things up, is try to make the smallest cell possible. Lower down the power, find the spots where you need wireless access, and try to get away with the smallest amount of transmit power possible, because that opens up that band for all the other wireless devices that you have in your home. Now, let's go back to my wide shot. A lot of people do something like this, where they will take their router, and let's say they'll just drop it right here. Here's their wireless router, because it's right next to the TV, it's right next to the cable modem. The problem is now it has to transmit to all these different parts of the house. You may have different types of construction. You may have masonry. You may have a lot of copper mesh. That's all going to affect how that signal propagates through the house. What a lot of noobs will do is they'll pump up that power and they'll push it out to the house. And that means, oh yeah, now when I'm sitting in the bathroom, which is actually here, but I'm going to pretend it's over here. When I'm sitting in the bathroom, I may look like I have signal to my tablet, but the problem is that's only in one direction. The tablet still has to transmit back to the access point, which is through all the same gunk, and therefore I have issues. Rather than taking that one AP and boosting up the power, what you want to do is find the dead spots and install other APs, smaller routers at a much lower signal strength. And what you do is you set it, say, for this for channel 1, this for channel 6, and this for channel 11. When you have that, they're no longer competing with one another. I can now blanket the entire house with a minimal amount of transmit power, which means my devices don't have to scream, which means my battery lasts longer, which means I get higher throughput, which means I am happy padre. That's how that works. Now, there is one little trick that you're going to want to know before you start buying extra routers to toss into your home, and that is turn off DHCP. I cannot tell you how many times I've walked into a family member's house and they've turned on DHCP on all their routers, which means every time it moves from one room to the next, one AP to the next, it has to renew its DHCP address. Instead, you choose one device that is going to be providing all your DHCP services, and for everything else, you turn it off. You just shut off the DHCP, so rather than acting as a router, those extra routers are acting as access points, wireless access points that serve out the same DHCP pool, the IP address pool from that that initial connection. Now, these are just a few things that you can do. This is really wireless 101. And again, this is operating in 2.4 gigahertz. We're going to do a more advanced episode in the future that's going to show you how you can use 5 gigahertz to really, really push it forward. But before we move on, I want to give you just a few more hints. The first is antennas are great. I love antennas. They increase signal sensitivity, and they allow me to get a bit more range out of my devices. But you have to know what they're used for. This is an omnidirectional, which means it's going to be blasting out energy in all directions. Can be helpful if you have a round room, but you would prefer to have something like this. This is a panel antenna. This antenna, if you could get my product shot, is only going to shoot energy in one direction. You can limit the amount of backscatter, and you can also increase the sensitivity from one direction. If you want to get really crazy, you move from the panel antenna into something like this. This is an old-fashioned shotgun. This gives me a really narrow azimuth of direction that it's going to shoot energy down and receive energy back in order to give me a really nice directional pathway to the devices I'm going to be using. What you can do is study up on antennas, find the different kind of radiation emission patterns, and then choose the ones that work best for your house. Now, Brian, tell me, with all that information, are you going to go home and fix your Wi-Fi?
That's the first thing I'm going to do when I get home.
What do you think is the thing that's you'll do first? Because there was a lot of information here.
I'm going to use Wi-Fi analyzer, and then I'm going to pick a channel first is the first thing I'm going to do.
Right.
And then next, I'll probably try and put an antenna on the other side of my apartment. Because, like you said, my cable box is in the living room, and then my bedroom is all the way across like the furthest room away, and that's where the signal's the weakest.
Right, right. Yeah, no, and I think you got it right. First thing you want to do is just check the channels. Make sure that you're 1, 6, and 11. That in itself is going to give you a 20%, 30% gain over what you have if you have conflicting channels. Yeah, and that second thing, start poking around the settings of your router. Don't just turn it on and assume everything is good. Actually jump in and learn a little bit about your wireless setup. Now, that's all the time we have for this episode of Know How. We showed you a lot of stuff. We showed you how to do time-lapse with a GoPro. We showed you how to fix your Dogecoin miner. And we showed you some basic Wi-Fi setup techniques. If you want to find out anything about any of the projects that we did and find the links to all the little tools that I talked about, you're going to want to go to our show notes page because our show notes page is second to none. You're going to find that at twit.tv/KH. I promise we'll try to get it up as soon as possible. I'm trying to get it up within 30 minutes, but my TD Brian, he's really slow. He's really.
Oh, yeah. Blame me, huh?
It's me. It's only me. I'm just lazy. Also, did you know that you could reach us other than the show notes? You can actually email us at knowhow@twit.tv. But more importantly, you can find us on our social media outreach. The best place right now is our G+ page. It is hopping. It is a great community. Brilliant people, very imaginative people, and people who can actually help you. It doesn't have to always be me. Go to gplus.to/twitkh. Join up with the group, suggest a project for the future, and you know what? I can almost guarantee that I'll talk to you. You're going to see me in there all the time. In fact, anytime I'm not in the studio, I'm typically in the G+ page, either laughing at a comment or thinking about turning someone's idea to a future episode of Know How. You can also find me on Twitter at PadreSJ. That's at PadreSJ, twitter.com/PadreSJ. There you'll be able to find what I do in between episodes of Know How, and also you'll be able to suggest something that you want to see. Finally, Snubs. She's my super producer. She's off camera right now. She's staring at me. What else do I need to tell the good folks? She's giving me this sort of cat-like thing. Oh, do it now. That's right. Now that you know,